The sound of your city. CIUT 89.5, Toronto. Listen to us on the go with TuneIn Radio's free app. Or go to the live stream at www.ciut.fm. Right here, right now, every day. CIUT 89.5 FM.
And we're back. It's the Taylor Report. That was, of course, earlier you heard Lee Morgan, Sidewinder. And remember, Lee Morgan was one of those who took inspiration from the Black Panthers and others, and he led musicians in protest to fight for recognition of black musicians and to let their faces be seen on American television. There was a time when that didn't happen. Phil, you have an announcement?
Well, just a quick thank you to all of our listeners who contributed during our recent donation drive. And you still have a chance to donate. Go to the website ciut.fm. We set a $60,000 goal. We've gone right past it, but we want you to keep giving. And we're having a great year. We want to thank all of the listeners out there who have given such an unprecedented level of support to CIUT this year.
Thank you. And I think we're joined now by Stephen Gowans, gowans.wordpress.com, what's left. And are you there, sir?
I am. Hello, Phil.
I'm really glad to be talking to you today because we are following a matter that you've written considerable about. And indeed, I got to remind people, you have a book coming out on the whole issue of what has happened in contemporary Syria. I always have to do the two cities story in my mind. There is an armed group in the city of in the eastern part of Aleppo. They seem to be rather ferocious, and they at once tried to capture the entire city. They seem to have failed, but they're desperate fellows, and I'm not sure what name they go by at the moment. I guess it's IS, I'm going to say, and you can correct me. And the neighboring city of Mosul, a similar group, and I don't know there is much distinction. Again, I'm going to ask you to clarify that for me, is fighting the Iraqi government, and U.S. and others are involved. So today's report from Mosul in The Guardian, the newspaper, the headline says, "We are fighting the devil himself." That's who we're fighting. That's the British paper, The Guardian. Can't go wrong with that. However, I read the Toronto Star, Globe and Mail, New York Times, Washington Post, at London, Telegraph, etc. In Aleppo, they are fighting rebels. And the rebels are having all kinds of problems because they keep missing the rebels and hitting hospitals and the last hospital, the last kitten, the last whatever. Why is this story so crazy? What's the political differences between the I'm going to call them IS of Mosul and the IS of Aleppo?
Yeah, what's the difference is that, in Aleppo.
Miles?
Pardon me?
Kilometers or miles? I'm sorry.
I mean, Mosul is held by Islamic State, which comes from Al-Qaeda. And, the main rebel group or insurgent group in Aleppo is Jaish al-Fatah, which is a coalition led by Al-Qaeda, which includes other Islamist groups, Ahrar al-Sham, and also U.S.-armed Islamist auxiliaries, you might call them, mm-hmm. Which share weapons with the Al-Qaeda lead group. The Al-Qaeda lead group is al-Nusra, Jabhat al-Nusra. Interestingly, al-Nusra is the largest Al-Qaeda group in the world, something that's not often acknowledged, but it is Al-Qaeda. It's Al-Qaeda mm-hmm. in Syria. So, mm-hmm. But the auxiliaries, the U.S.-armed Islamist auxiliaries, share weapons with Al-Qaeda. They coordinate on the battlefield. They're enmeshed with Al-Qaeda. Effectively, they are Al-Qaeda, and they provide a conduit through which the United States and its allies can provide arms and other support to Al-Qaeda. So it is that group that is currently in eastern Aleppo, and which holds eastern Aleppo, and which the Syrian government, with the assistance of Russia and Iran, are trying to capture.
Mm-hmm. By the way, again, yes, and we have missed some interesting representations. I read the Globe and Mail on the weekend, and they, one of their journalists, had did a detailed analysis, and he seems to think that we're seeing a fight between ethnic, and pardon me, not ethnic groups, the Islamic groups of Sunni and Shia, and which is that's been an American formulation for a long time, and but that's how he's describing what is going on in Syria. You've written about this extensively. Is that accurate?
Well, I mean that's kind of an imperialist formation. I mean, if you want to dominate a country or a territory, what you do is you find cleavages within the country, and then you try and exacerbate them. Or you always see the country within those terms, which can be religious terms, sectarian terms. But it's really a political conflict. It's not a sectarian conflict. There may be sectarian elements that are kind of the concomitants of this political conflict, but it's not the Alawites, for example, has often been said. It's like an Alawite-led government that's imposing an Alawite agenda upon the Sunni majority. That's complete nonsense. And that's nonsense that serves the interests of political Islamists, who are the Al-Qaeda group, fighting, you know, this secular Arab nationalist state.
Mm-hmm.
What they try to do is invoke the sectarian reasons or justification for their fight, but it's really a political conflict, and a political conflict between two different ideologies. One ideology is secular Arab nationalism, as represented by the Syrian government, and the other ideology is Sunni political Islam, as represented by Al-Qaeda or Islamic State.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I noticed something. There have been reports in the past couple of weeks. I don't know how far to credit it, but Egypt has begun to talk as though, indeed has said, they don't agree with attacking assaults on Syria, and they don't agree on the U.S. language of President Assad must step down. Egypt is a big country. And it's, if you wanted to call it that, Sunni. When I read, I think his name is McGibbon in the Globe, he didn't seem to be aware of that. Also, he doesn't seem to be aware that many Arabs are Sunni who are quite friendly to the government of Syria, including Algeria.
Yeah. And, I mean, that kind of underscores the point that I'm making, that it's a political conflict between two different kinds of ideologies. There's this Sunni political Islam, which is expressed in this case by Al-Qaeda, but derives from the Muslim Brotherhood. And then there's the secular Arab nationalism or secularism. So the Egyptian government embraces secularism, and the long-time foe of the Egyptian secular government has been the Muslim Brotherhood. And, of course, it was a Muslim Brotherhood-led government under Morsi that the current Egyptian government overthrew.
Mm-hmm.
But that accounts, you know, for the alignment between Egypt as a secular government and the Syrian government also as a secular government.
Yeah. I always thought that was a striking detail of the struggle that went on there between the army and I think – I can't even say his name anymore. Was it Morsi? Modi, Egypt, is that he had begun to make public calls to recruit Egyptian volunteers to go fight on the side of the jihadists in Syria. And it was with about 48 hours of him starting to do that in public that he was in big trouble. I assume there's a connection. We're speaking, by the way, to Stephen Gowans. It's gowans.wordpress.com. com. I want to mention somebody else that also is a factor that our listeners should hear about, or the name. We've just lost the great Cuban revolutionary leader, Fidel, and his government and the government of Syria are very close. And they've the government of Syria was one of those who made a strong statement and out of respect and appreciation of Fidel. And it was mutual. Why does Cuba take this view of Syria?
Well, I think there would be a number of reasons, but Cuba certainly provided assistance, both in whatever way it could, to groups that are seeking emancipation from domination from outside powers. Certainly, Cuban foreign policy was anti-colonial. The policy of the Syrian government is anti-colonial, and because the Syrian government under Assad is led by secular Arab nationalists, by the Ba'athist Party, which is committed to probably, in many respects, the same values that the Cuban Revolution was committed to. The slogan of the Ba'athists is freedom, socialism, and liberation. So the idea of freedom is freedom from foreign domination. Certainly the Cuban Revolution had freedom from foreign domination as one of its central ideas. There's liberty, and that means, you know, I mentioned freedom, socialism. Socialism, obviously, a plank of the Cuban Revolution. In the case of the Arab nationalists, the socialism is a little bit different, and its goals are a little bit different than the socialism of the Cuban Revolution.
Mm-hmm.
But in many respects, what they're trying to achieve is very similar.
Yeah, and don't they face something similar that we're not reminded of enough, which is sanctions, and very heavy sanctions? Incidentally, for all the friendliness between the, I don't know why I'm calling it friendliness, the visit of Obama to Cuba, the embargo remains, and the sanctions remain. And in the case of Syria, they've brought that to Syria's door, which harms them, their ability to get medicine, the ability to trade and have any kind of economy at all. That's a kind of a siege that's been applied to them, which it makes the Syrians have to be in a relatively desperate situation, even if they were, if there's no war with sanctions of the type that the U.S. is bringing and their allies. It's similar to what Cuba faced.
Yes, I mean, that's a good point. And the sanctions that have been imposed on Syria are often not noted or acknowledged, but they have been imposed since 2003. Interestingly, at the moment sanctions were lifted on what had been Arab nationalist Iraq, they were imposed on Arab nationalist Syria. And their effects have been devastating, but the effects have often not been acknowledged. I mean, but these sanctions imposed by the United States and by the EU are essentially a blocking of almost all products to Syria and also financial isolation. These plunged Syria's economy into crisis before 2011. Everyone thinks that this kind of conflict between the United States and EU in Syria began in 2011 with the so-called Arab Spring, but it happened much earlier. And the United States, as early as 2003, was trying to oust the government in Damascus. And those sanctions caused unemployment to shoot up, led to factory closures, to food prices skyrocketing, to fuel prices doubling. And if you read even, you know, established newspapers like the New York Times or the Washington Post or Wall Street Journal, you'll see that before 2011, you'll see acknowledgement there that Syrian officials were forced to stop providing education and health care and other essential services in some parts of the country as a result of these sanctions. In fact, by 2011, when we had the outbreak of this insurgency in Syria, which U.S. officials were then blaming on the Assad government, they acknowledged that the country was under so many sanctions that they had little leverage in terms of implying more sanctions.
Mm-hmm.
Also, there's been a leaked U.N. internal report that says that the sanctions have blocked access to blood safety equipment, and to medicines, to medical devices, to food, fuel, water pumps, spare plant parts for power plants. And also an acknowledgement that these sanctions have caused huge suffering among ordinary Syrians and have prevented the delivery of humanitarian aid.
And it's designed to make them, as Ronald Reagan happily said about Nicaragua, I want them to say uncle.
Yes, exactly. Patrick.
Hurt them until they say uncle, which is, I'm sorry, I left out Sam. Say Uncle Sam. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
The British journalist, the veteran journalist Patrick Coburn, had noted in respect of the sanctions that, in effect, that the United States and EU were imposing an economic siege on Syria, which may be killing more Syrians than die of illness and malnutrition in sieges that the EU and U.S. leaders were describing as war crimes that were connected with Syrian efforts to capture cities from al-Qaeda.
Mm-hmm. Well, that would be a parallel with what happened in Iraq when they, before they assaulted Iraq directly, they, under Bill Clinton for 8 years, and my memory is that they had a no-fly zone in the north and the south, and they had an embargo, which meant that children were dying because there were no medicines, and the numbers are very high. Of course, we all remember that Madeleine Albright thought that that was okay. She said it was worth it that the Iraqi children die. This is very important to raise today because, of course, the British seem to be back in the mode that our brothers and sisters around the world would remember them when the British Empire was all over the globe, lecturing and patronizing everyone about how bad the Russians are being. But the Russian ambassador said, you haven't produced a gram of anything to help those people. We set up quarters. We want to get food to them. You, Britain, have not done a damn thing.
Well, nothing positive anyway. Certainly done a lot of negative in actually providing support to the insurgency against the Syrian government and to backing those sanctions. And another interesting thing about all this condemnation of Russia, this is something that's been pointed out by the Russian historian Stephen Cohen. He says, you know, not too long ago, if we recall, Obama had agreed with Putin to undertake the joint U.S. military campaign against what they called the terrorists in Aleppo, who are now being called just moderate rebels. But back then, they were terrorists. So that agreement collapsed when, if you recall, the U.S. war planes attacked Syrian forces.
Yes. And that was an accident, a complete accident. Yes.
And some have argued that this was done deliberately by the Pentagon because they objected to the deal that Obama had worked out with Putin. But the terrorists have now, as Cohen points out, they've now been deleted from the U.S. narrative. And now they accuse Russia of war crimes in Aleppo for the same military campaign Washington was to have been a full partner in.
Yes. So when they withdrew from the process, it became a war crime. And if they were in on it, it would not be a war crime because they're wearing a badge.
Well, exactly.
This is Stephen Gowans, by the way. This is gowans.wordpress.com. Brilliant articles every time. And Stephen, you've already written on this, but again, I have to ask you to repeat the subject. The Globe and Mail decided to do their big feature on finding the young man who had written the original graffiti, which changed the whole world. He's the parallel to the man who assassinated Ferdinand, if I got the right guy. And I think the assassin got the right guy, if I didn't get it. But you say in your writings that isn't accurate. That didn't start this armed struggle. Tell us what was the real story.
Yeah, well, that's kind of an interesting story. I mean, if you look at the story about the graffiti daubed on the walls, and you go back to the press reports about March of 2011 when this is supposed to have happened, you'll see different accounts of what actually went on. Some of the accounts say that some youth scribbled some graffiti on the walls. Others say that the youth were killed or murdered by the security forces. And others say that this didn't happen at all, and it's a complete fiction.
Mm-hmm.
But what did happen, I mean, what seems to have been associated with the... what seems to have precipitated the insurgency is essentially a riot. Mm-hmm. A riot that happened in Dera, in the middle of March 2011. It was a riot in which government buildings were attacked, were set fire to, in which people were attacked who were associated with the government.
Mm-hmm.
And the government, the Syrian government, replied in the manner in which any government would reply. I mean, through the use, as the Canadian security forces would reply to some kind of, riotous demonstration.
Introduction of guns and the cutting the throats of policemen will certainly upset security forces.
Well, exactly.
Anywhere in the world.
Exactly. And from the earliest days, again, if you go back and you start looking at some of the early press reports, you'll see an acknowledgement, even an acknowledgement by the United States government, that there was violence involved in the early days.
Yes.
This has kind of been rewritten. Now people like to talk about how the early demonstrations were largely nonviolent.
No.
But, I mean, largely nonviolent essentially implies that they were violent. The violence.
Yes.
Were violence, and burning buildings and rioting is certainly violence.
Yeah, and very quickly and out of nowhere comes Saudi money, Turkish involvement, this and Jordanian. We leave out all these devils who got involved. Clearly, and then we have to remember, as Mr. Gaddafi was in trouble, I heard leaders of France and Britain and United States say publicly, we're looking at you, Assad. We're looking at you, which meant that's even incitement. If they didn't put their hand directly in, they're inciting people to take action, violent action against their own government.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
I guess I got you to agree on that. I'm sorry we don't have a lot of time. We've been talking to Stephen Gowans, and we really appreciate your work, Stephen. Look forward to that book.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Okay. Bye bye. This is Taylor Report, CIUT 89.5 FM, and you can find us facebook.com/TheTaylorReport. Phil Connor has been here. Thank you, Phil, very much. And again, we congratulate the Dakota Access Pipeline demonstrators, people who stood with Standing Rock, bless their hearts. And go to Susan Sarandon. Go to Kaepernick, the football player, Twitter. Yesterday, he was celebrating the birthday of Fred Hampton of the Black Panthers of Chicago, who was murdered by the Chicago police. That's where you get your information, actors and football players. This is Taylor Board. See you next week.